Welcome back to the Management Lab. I'm Sean Hansen from Saunders College of Business at Rochester Institute of Technology.
And I'm Uri Gull from the University of Sydney Business School. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Uri.
How are you doing?
It's been a while since we've talked, so I know all of our loyal listeners have been waiting with bated breath for the new episode to drop.
It's actually been a while since we've talked off air as well, not just on air.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a difficult guy to pin down. You're very busy.
Well, our semester is just wrapping up as we head into the summer. You are heading into the winter, and so I, for once, am in a more enviable position. So usually we like to start our discussion with something lighthearted, but the world is burning down around us.
It is, isn't it? Right? This certainly feels like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly feels like... I don't know how to say this without making a political statement, but I don't want to make a political statement about what's happening in Israel and Gaza, because it feels like everything that's happening on US, European, and even Australian campuses, it feels like it's almost entirely divorced from what's happening in Gaza and Israel. It seems like there's a sort of a thought bubble that's kind of detach itself from that context and taking a life of its own.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. And the other thing that you see in a lot of the campus discussion or lack of discussion in the US, because it's mostly chanting and shouting, is a lack of nuance. And the reality is that this is a very complex geopolitical dynamic with a lot of historical antecedents. No one is comfortable with nuance in our current moment. The complete loss of appetite for nuance or tolerance for nuance is a real challenge in our current moment.
Another thing that I thought was very funny was, and again, we talked about this briefly off air before we started, given the absurdity of some of the recent events on US campuses, I can't tell anymore if some of the reporting is real or if it's somebody making satirical observations about what is happening. And one of the reporting was that at Columbia, after they've been dispersed by the police the other day, right? Because they went into campus and arrested a bunch of people and everybody else was made to leave. Now they're asking the university to cancel their exams because they're too distressed.
Yeah, this is one of the things that really kills me about a lot of the issues, that the people protesting and painting themselves as oppressed are some of the most privileged people on the face of the earth. I say this as a graduate of an Ivy League institution, but an Ivy League student in 2024 is among the most privileged people that have ever walked the face of the earth. And yet they seem supremely lacking in self-reflection in that regard.
Yeah. Anyway, there's much more to say about this, but I guess we can...
We'll move on. It's very stressful. It's a very stressful...
you're getting stressed out, Sean.
Yeah, set of topics. And that is our segue, because tonight we're going to be talking about techno-stress. And I think it's a really important domain. And it's one that was very lively in the research literature in the early 2000s and maybe a little less lately, but I'm really inclined to think that we're going to see a revitalization of it in the wake of the introduction of generative AI and things like that, because some of the elements that we'll discuss this evening are rife for techno-stress applications.
So maybe before we get into that, we'll just give a brief definition of what it is so that everybody knows what we're actually talking about. Does that sound okay to you?
Sounds good.
So it's the situation of stress experienced by individuals because of their inability to adapt to the introduction of a new technology in a healthy manner. That's the definition from the literature, the research literature on what techno-stress is. So it's an inability to adapt by people to the introduction of new technologies in a healthy way, which results in a sensation of stress.
Yep.
And so shall we talk about some of the major types of techno-stress?
Yeah, the stressors. I think one of the really valuable things in this literature is that it doesn't treat techno-stress as a monolithic thing, but it says there are different types of stressors that emerge in the use of technology. And it seems to me that over the course of this literature, there's sort of five that have emerged as the key pieces.
But before you get into them, Sean, can I just quickly say, so in terms of the structure of the conversation, I think we'll try to kind of make it useful by talking about the different types of techno stress. But we will discuss why we think it's important to talk about this by outlining the implications of these different types of techno stress for different types of organizational outcome variables like performance and innovation and well-being and stuff like that.
Yep.
Okay, so go ahead.
So different techno-stressors, right? Things that are causing techno-stress. One is techno-complexity. So this idea that the technologies in place are so complex that it sort of inhibits the ability of people, organizational members, to make sense out of them. Mm-hmm. So that's one, just the complexity is too high. Second is techno-invasion, which is this idea of technology encroaching upon various aspects of one's life, specifically, you know, the work-life balance, which we can get into some more, but this idea that it's technology starting to invade all aspects of your life. Techno overload, which is the idea of technology increasing your workload and making you feel like there's too much information or too many tasks to attend to. The fourth is techno insecurity, which is the idea of fears about job insecurity created by technology. That's the one that, of course, you know, rises immediately to my mind with regard to the current discussions around generative AI adoption. But the idea that the technology might start to make your job obsolescent, and so you are insecure in your job. And then lastly is techno uncertainty, which is this idea that the pace of change with regard to technology is so high that it creates stress around people, you know, trying to adapt to continual new technologies as they're introduced.
Right. So do you find that, or is your view that the main thing that's playing out today, especially in the context of generative AI technologies, is the risk of the stress that emanates from the potential of people to be replaced, for people to be replaced by technology?
So that's the one that just sort of resonates with me, because I think a lot of the discussion around the current AI expansion and introduction is, you know, holy shit, are we going to have, you know, massive job displacement, technology driven displacement because of these technologies? And I think we are starting to see some of that. There was, I'm trying to think of what firm it was, but they said that they were able to get, you know, this huge jump in efficiencies. And it did come with, the colloquial term is headcount reduction, meaning we don't need as many people to do the same work that we used to, right? And so I do think that's one of the big drivers, but I don't think that's alone. I think that this technology uncertainty is a very real one, right? People thinking, oh, things are changing so fast. How do I keep pace? Yeah, you know, how do I stay in step with the new things as they're introduced? Can I? And I think that the one that certainly does always resonate with me is the techno invasion, this idea of, you know, technology creeping into so many aspects of our lives and blurring lines that used to be quite prominent. Are there any of those techno stressors that strike you as particularly significant when you look at your own experience or your own reflections?
I'm still in the process of learning and trying to figure out what I think is going to be the actual impact of generative AI technologies on work displacement. Because my sense is that there's been so much chatter around these technologies and what they can do. But my sense is that so much of this chatter has been manufactured intentionally by people who have a vested interest in seeing these tools promoted at scale and use that scale. And I still am at least partly skeptical about what these things can do, because I think they have some fundamental flaws that inevitably is going to make them, if not completely unsuitable for various areas of work, that require, for instance, reliability, accuracy, and a certain degree of objectivity and optimization towards truth. Like, for instance, in medical research or medicine in general, or in a law practice, for instance. I think the application of these tools is going to need to be done in a very considered way, with lots of guardrails and human supervision on top of that.
Yeah, I think we're definitely at the top, the height of the hype curve. And I think we are, with regard to a lot of generative AI right now, at the peak of inflated expectations. So I agree that it remains to be seen where it's going to go. But I think it is creating sort of a new wave or a different wave of technology-driven stress, right? Work stress.
Because of people's concern that they might be replaced by an AI tool or for other reasons as
So
well.
yeah, I think it's those two. I think it's the insecurity that my job's going to go away, and also the I guess it's the uncertainty piece, right? Of how do I constantly stay on top of the trends? Can I? It's changing so rapidly. Can I stay on top of the new things?
Yeah, I gotta say, so I think that in some ways the so I was playing around with I wasn't playing around, I was using GPT-4 yesterday for our research, as it were. So I gave it a screenshot of a model that we're using in one of our papers that talks about the ironic effects that unfold as a consequence of the introduction of a new technology into an organization. So it's like a PowerPoint diagram. And I asked GPT-4 to tell me what the model says, and it produced this text that really accurately describes the model.
Really
Yeah.
interesting.
So,
Well, that's
and
good. That just means we made a good model.
I is really
That's my interpretation. That's how I choose to interpret that.
that's perhaps,
Yeah.
and of course the model has words in it. So
Yep.
it's not just boxes and arrows, but the boxes are labeled and the arrows are labeled. But still, the ability of the model to interpret this fairly accurately, not perfectly, but fairly accurately, was quite impressive.
Yeah.
But like I said before, I think there's obvious limitations to these technologies that I'm not sure are fixable, like their profound unreliability. And people who are experts in the field way more than I am say that these hallucinations, as they're called, it's not a bug that you can get rid of. It's one of the fundamental principles of these LLMs, these large language models. And it's not just a matter of feeding them more data or changing their training processes in some way. We need a whole new way of thinking about AI if we want to get rid of these hallucinations. So all this is to say that I think that there's great promises and probably very useful applications of them in the workplace, but in many areas, I would be very reluctant to just use them willy-nilly without thinking about how we make sure that we use them in a way that's more productive than destructive.
Absolutely. So, why should we care? Why should we care about techno stress?
So we should care about techno stress because, first of all, it's a special case of stress. Right. It's a unique type of stress. And as we know, too much stress in the workplace and outside of the workplace has very negative consequences for the well-being of individuals. And we've had a variety of studies over the years that have looked at the negative consequences of techno stress in the workplace. So one particular study that comes to mind is a 2015 paper by Tarafdar and Bullman and Raghunathan. And the title of the paper is Techno Stress, Negative Effect on Performance and Possible Mitigations. It was published in Information Systems Journal. And they point out in that, so it's an empirical study that they did, and they look at the consequences of different types of techno stress creators, which we can elaborate on this a little bit in a second, on the performance of salespeople, because they looked at salespeople particularly, but also on on broader categories of performance in organizations like innovation. And they found very clearly that techno stress creators had a negative effect both on sales performance and on innovation. And just to clarify, when we talk about techno stress creators, I look at the different types of them. And to illustrate, I'll just read out a few examples from the paper. So things that were reflective of techno stress creators were statements like, I'm forced by this technology to work much faster. I spend less time with my family because of technology. I don't know enough about this technology to handle my job in a satisfactory manner. I feel a constant threat to my job security because of this new technology.
So they really, all those techno stress creators are really the embodiment of the stressors that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, right? There's a very close overlap there. Yeah. And like I said, they found a very significant negative relationship between those techno stress creators and innovation in the workplace, and also a negative effect between those techno stress creators and sales performance.
Yeah, I think the focus specifically on sales was very interesting here, because I do think sales has some unique characteristics. It's highly competitive. You know, sales is one of the few places in the contemporary workplace where you still see stack ranking in organizations, where it's like everyone gets ranked from best to worst. So the competition is very high. The expectation of relational pieces, like face-to-face time with clients and things like that, is very high. Just anecdotally, I lots of the people that I know who are in sales were some of the people most resistant to the adoption of technology like customer relationship management tools. My father-in-law was in sales for many, many years. And when the expectation became that he was going to use certain platforms to do his work is when he finally said, I think it's time to retire.
But is it a generational thing, or is it because of the nature of the profession, do you think?
So I think it's a little of both. I think there is a generational element, certainly in that case. But I also think it's in the nature of the profession. One of the really interesting things about sales professionals is that the relational piece is so high that there's, I think, a little resistance to putting data into a system, right? Sales professionals they want their employer to find them irreplaceable, right? And if they own the relationship with a client, then they're irreplaceable. If you put a lot of that information related to that relationship into a system, then it makes them a little less irreplaceable, because then presumably if you left the organization, somebody else could come in and manage that relationship as well, because you had captured all that information in the system. So I think it is one of these domains that where some of the hurdles around the mandatory use of technology are a little higher.
Okay, so I take your point. I will say, though, that we've seen other studies that examine the negative consequences of techno stress on various outcome variables that are not specifically related to sales performance.
Yeah, right. General implications are things like job satisfaction is reduced when the use of technology is leading to discernible stressors like the ones we talked about. Job satisfaction goes down, turnover goes up, intention to leave the profession goes up. Again, innovation, ability to innovate is reduced. So the negative consequences of techno stress are very clear.
So if we look at this in a bit more detail, one of the other papers that we looked at was by Iyagari et al., Techno Stress, Technological Antecedents and Implications, that was published in 2011. And that's one of those papers, I believe it was super heavily cited, like thousands of different citations. And they looked at different types of techno stress characteristics, they call them. So for instance, they looked at the usefulness of technology, and the less useful people find it, the more stressful they find using this technology. They looked at things like complexity, which we kind of touched on before. So overly complex technologies would tend to cause more stress. Reliability, meaning how dependable and consistent a technology is. The less it is, the more stress it's going to generate. How often it changes, right? So that's something you talked about before as well. Presenteeism, which is an interesting idea.
Really interesting. So yeah, you're right. This paper, one of the things I really appreciate in this study is that they really delve into the characteristics of the technology more than some of the other research. A lot of the other research just focuses on the stress that people are experiencing based on the technology, but this one really delves into what are the characteristics of the technology that have these different implications. And so that
presenteeism, I thought, was particularly relevant in our day and age. So just to kind of give a brief definition, that's the degree to which a technology would enables individuals to be reachable. And of course, we all are reachable all the time these days, for the most part, right? We have phones in our pockets.
Yeah, and you're expected to be reachable.
So what they found in the study, again, that was an empirical piece, maybe not overly surprising, but nonetheless interesting and illuminating. The usefulness of technology was negatively correlated with work overload. So the more useful people felt the technologies that they were using were, the less overworked they felt. Mm-hmm. The reliability of the technology was also negatively correlated with work overload. Presenteeism was positively associated with homework conflict, which is not surprising, but interesting, with the invasion of privacy, with work overload, and with role ambiguity.
Yeah, which is this idea of, you know, what's my job? What's my job supposed to be? You know, what's inside and outside of the contours of what I'm expected to do? Yeah, I thought the impact of that presenteeism was...
Is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, I don't know. I would say presenteeism.
That sounds like a made-up word.
It does. Well, it is a bit of a made-up word. It's clearly a neologism, which is not a made-up word. But yeah, it definitely is. But that one really resonated with me. So this idea of technology enhancing the expectation that you will always be accessible was one of the huge antecedents for all these stresses, right? And maybe the reason this resonates with me is that email is the bane of my existence. I hate email. I hate it because I spend hours every day just going through email. And there are people who, like, they'll send you an email and you'll get a follow-up or a knock on the door 20 minutes later. Didn't you see my email from 20 minutes ago? And it's like, yeah, I saw it. I can't attend to it right now. Or maybe I didn't see it because I shut down my email for a couple hours every day, because if I didn't, I wouldn't get any work done.
You do that?
I do. Yeah. I will not look at emails for a couple hours, particularly if you and I are research collaborators. If I want to work on a paper, I will shut my Outlook, because I am not going to... Email has that, you know, it's that old Stephen Covey thing about urgency versus importance. Hmm. Email has an urgency to it. It pops up in the corner of the window and you feel like you have to address it. If it pops up, oh, I got to attend to it. And it will just distract you from all other work. So absolutely, I will just close Outlook for a couple hours if I feel like I have to box some time and actually make some progress on something. I hate email and I'm inundated with it.
Another thing that I found interesting was the usefulness of technology and how it's negatively related to work overload. So the less useful it is, the more overworked people feel that they are. And it resonates with me so strongly because we use another system at the university called Concur to do our expenses.
Hmm.
And it's evident that that system was designed by an accountant. We use the system to log our expenses and get reimbursements from the university. And it could be something as mundane as...
A cup of coffee. Or a meeting.
Yes, that's right. So it would be $5. Mm-hmm. And to log these $5 into the system could take, for somebody who's not a regular user, like 15, 20 minutes. Because it's not self-evident what you need to do. And it's so... And when these things accumulate over the course of a month, let's say, it's like you need to devote a couple of hours for this.
Yeah, yeah. Which is ironic, right? It's actually ironic in its outcomes, because you're talking about something... That the original expense was $5. It's costing way more than $5.
Yeah.
In your value, in the value of your time to enter it into the system.
A lot more. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is to me a great example of. I think in a previous episode, we talked about Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian media theorist. And one of the principles that he talked about was reversal, that any medium, when pushed beyond its usefulness, actually inverts the value that it was intended for. So in the case of email, the whole premise of email was facilitating communication, but it's been pushed to the point where it actually inhibits communication because it's way past its usefulness at this point.
So I'm realizing that as we're speaking about this, and perhaps it's not surprising given the subject matter of which is techno stress, that we've focused on the negative consequences.
Mm-hmm.
At least one paper that we looked at tried to create a more balanced view of techno stress and its implications for people and organizations. So this is a paper by Caliph Sarkar and Sarkar, MIS Quarterly, 2020. So this is a pretty recent paper.
Mm-hmm.
And what they try to do there is to, so it's a mixed method study that uses both qualitative interviews with people. And on the basis of these interviews, they've constructed a theoretical model and with a bunch of hypotheses. And then they tested the hypotheses empirically. And so they look at two different classes of techno stressors, which they call challenge and hindrance techno stresses.
Mm-hmm.
And so for instance, some challenge technostresses include things like usefulness of the technology, support of the technology, and the degree to which it can facilitate involvement in work. And hindrance technostresses include things like what we've talked about before, basically unreliability, complexity, uncertainty, insecurity, and overload. So exactly what we've talked about before. And what they find in the study is that the challenge techno stresses, usefulness, support, and involvement facilitation actually have a positive psychological effect.
Yeah, the whole framing of the challenge stressors is that they're actually like positive stressors, things that make you that you think induce you to maybe be more effective in your job.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically relate the challenge stressors and the hindrance stressors to two different what they call sub-processes. One is called, I would pronounce it eustress, like eudaimonia, right?
Mm.
So E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, eustress and distress. I love this paper because I thought it was a great example of the of real mixed methods, right? Where they
But let me just finish describing the model and the consequences that the model shows. So, okay. Like you said, like I said before, the challenge stresses lead to positive psychological responses. The hindrance stresses to negative responses, and the positive psychological responses are positively correlated with job satisfaction and reduced turnover intention. Right, so people are less likely to leave their jobs, and negative psychological responses are positively related to attrition and consequently to turnover intention.
Mm-hmm. And this was specifically in a healthcare context. So I was looking at nurses and the use of health information technology. My point was that I struggled a little bit with it. As much as I really like the study, I think it's really interesting because it takes a more nuanced approach to stress. Let's not just assume that it's always negative. There could be stressors that actually enhance our ability to do our work. And again, it was this great real mixed methods approach where they did this rich qualitative analysis that fed into theory development and then followed it up with theory testing in a quantitative fashion. But I do struggle a little bit because like the eustress and the challenge stressors seem like something else to me, right? That seems like they're not really stress, right? It seems like a mislabeling. Even the phrase challenge stress is positive stressors. Well, I don't know. When I hear challenge, I don't feel like it's necessarily positive.
Well, I guess you could look at it as like a continuum where you have too little stimulation on the one end of it and too much stimulation on the other end of it. And I guess too much would be stress and too little would be negative stress. And so if you look at it that way,
mm-hmm.
I guess you could make the point that some stress is positive and other stress is negative.
Yeah. One of the fascinating things in that study was they had hypothesized that tech support, right? So technical support for the nurses, again, in this case, because it's in a healthcare context, would create a positive psychological response, right? Would be one of those challenge techno-stressors that has a positive side. But the finding was that it was significant, but inverse of what they hypothesized. So actually, greater technical support actually was negatively correlated to positive psychological response. So more tech support actually led to less positive response, which is pretty fascinating to me.
How do you explain that?
Well, I can tell you how they explained it, which was that in this particular case, because it's in a healthcare context, that you have different language games. So that the people in the nursing role and the people in the tech support role, they have different language, right? They speak different languages. And so the tech support actually was sort of like increasing negative stress because it was like they're speaking a different language and they were making the respondents feel like maybe they were not understanding or it was in a zone that made them uncomfortable. And so that was their explanation, but it was quite intriguing to me. It kind of makes me think of the old Saturday Night Live bit. Jimmy Fallon used to have this character called Nick Burns, your company computer guy. And it was a stereotypical, but not so inaccurate rendition of a tech guy, like a tech support guy, where he treats everyone like they're idiots and because they don't understand the technical features of things. And that was immediately what I thought of with regard to that, where the tech support can actually increase your negative stress rather than alleviate it.
Oh, to me, for non-American listeners, that reminded of, what's the name of that show? The IT Crowd?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, that was a hilarious show. That was a British show, right?
Yeah, I think it was British. And yeah, that's a bunch of people that certainly speak a different language to I would imagine what nurses are used to hearing in the workplace. So yeah, that's an interesting I guess that's an interesting explanation, different language games, as Wittgenstein would call them.
Yeah.
Another interesting distinction that another paper that we looked at made. So that's a paper by
Nastjuk et al.
Nastjuk et al. Thank you.
This was in Aegis. Sorry, European Journal of Information Systems.
Yeah. And they did a meta-analysis, meaning they analyzed existing studies on techno-stress to synthesize the findings from these studies. And one of the interesting distinctions that they made there was between psychological and behavioral effects of techno-stress.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, across the board, what they found was that the psychological effects of techno-stress were a lot more significant, or that's not the right word, statistically speaking, they were stronger in magnitudes.
Yeah, and also more initially prominent, meaning you have the psychological response right away, it might impact your behavior down the line, like behavior being like intention to continue to use something, but the psychological response is much more immediate. One of the other distinctions they drew, which I thought was quite interesting, was between organizational technology use and private technology use. And for the private technology use, they looked at a lot of the literature around social networking systems, right? So Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and the stresses that were induced there. They still measured them against the same stressors we looked at elsewhere, but it was kind of intriguing because what you see from that meta-analysis is that the impacts of those different stressors are not the same in an organizational context as in a private context. Some of them are much more pronounced in an organizational context, like your work life, and others were more pronounced in the private use.
So can you give a couple of examples?
Sure. So for example, techno overload was more pronounced in private usage than it was in organizational life. Or let me see if I can get one that's a really stark contrast. Yeah, the behavioral impacts of techno overload are significant, have a high, fairly high significance in the private life, like whether or not you're going to use something. Again, intention to use is a behavioral one. Well, if you feel overloaded, you can choose not to use systems in your private life. but it didn't have as much of an impact in an organizational context, which is not, that one's not so surprising because like at work, you're told what systems you're going to use and you just have to use it. I can choose not to use Facebook. I can't choose not to use the learning management system on campus or something like that. One of the other ones that was really interesting was techno invasion. Techno invasion has a much bigger impact in people's private lives than in their organizational lives, which again might just be like, it's part of my work life. I just have to use this thing. Whereas if it's technology in my private life, I feel like it's going to feel like it's encroaching upon my existence more.
Yeah. Interesting. I want to go back to a point you made before about the consequential order, well, the sequential order rather, of the effects of techno stress. So just to reiterate what you said before to make sure that I got this correctly and that everybody else understands this the same way. So the psychological effects of techno stress precede the behavioral effects, right? So the adverse psychological effects of feeling more stressed out would cause us to behave or change our behavior in a certain way following the interaction with the techno stresses, like invasion or complexity or uncertainty or whatever the case might be. And I think that that's a good observation. And it also explains why we see more pronounced effects for more pronounced psychological effects than behavioral effects, right? Because just because we have, or just because we feel a certain way or think a certain way about what has happened to us and about what we want to do as a consequence, not all these thoughts and feelings translate into actual behavior. There's a right? Some of these drop out along the way and don't actually get realized, which explains why the behavioral effects are smaller on average than the psychological effects. So, Sean, main takeaways from the conversation.
So, I mean, main takeaways are it's definitely real, right? Like this is something people are dealing with in their organizational lives, and we need to think about the degree to which technology is inducing stress that will have bad outcomes for the organizations that we run. From a managerial perspective, I think the question is, what do you do about it? How can you mitigate techno stress, right? And I think there were a couple that emerge in the literature, and some again are mixed, right? So one of the recommendations seems to focus on tech support, but as we've seen from the one study, that can be a double-edged sword, right? Like depending on the nature of the tech support, that could actually increase stress rather than mitigate it. The one that really jumped out to me in this regard was this idea. I think the phrase was involvement facilitation.
Yeah.
Meaning getting people involved in the design or redesign of systems has a big impact. So if people have an opportunity to make recommendations for improvements in the technologies they're using, you know, could we add this feature? Could we change this process? That dramatically reduces sensations of techno stress, right? And the psychological impacts of techno stress. So giving people avenues for voice in the design and redesign of the tools they use is a big one.
Yeah. Another thing I would say is that it's kind of a no-brainer, I guess, in a way. But at the same time, I've seen so many instances of this not happening, which is when you implement a system, make sure that it's actually usable to the people who are meant to use it. But it's not just a matter of getting people involved in the design process, which, by the way, rarely happens in many contexts, despite people like you and me and other IS professors talking about this for, I don't know, more than 20 years. We've talked about this for 20 years, but I'm sure people have talked about it before us. It doesn't happen very regularly. But also, I see systems being implemented that are just buggy. And they look like they've been designed in 1984 using a Commodore 64 or something.
Yeah.
It pains me to see this, and it happens all the time. And so, like I said, it's kind of a no-brainer. Make sure that the technology that you put in place, first of all, works properly, that it's not buggy, because many times it is, and that it actually correlates and help people get their job done. Like we said before, the example I gave about the expense acquittal system that we have, it's evident it wasn't designed by anybody who understands academic work. It was designed by an accountant, and with the jargon and the language of accountants.
I think this focus on design is actually really important. One of the things I always tell my students is every information system is designed to make someone's life easier. The problem is that that person might not be you, right? So if it's designed by the accounting team to make their lives easier, it can actually move inefficiencies around within the organization without creating more efficiency overall. And so I think a core focus on designing with an eye to users, you know, the whole empathy, user empathy, and user-centered design, I think is a big element of addressing techno-stress. How do we make sure that we're getting the voices of the people who will actually have to use these tools in the design and implementation of them?
Yeah. On the other hand, another thing that I would say, one of the big techno-stresses that we talked about was the pace of change of technology, which divorced from anything else, from everything else, people find stressful. Change is stressful. Mm-hmm. So some change is good, of course, and we need to stay adaptive to our environment for sure. But too much change can create unnecessary stress. And many leaders, especially when they start out in a new job, they feel like they need to, you know, make a statement. Mm-hmm. And leave their mark. And the introduction of new systems is oftentimes the way people do that. And of course, it's meant to support other changes that they might be introducing into the organization. But I would encourage people to engage in these activities with in a more judicious way and to really think about whether another change or another new system is really necessary, because it's pretty easy for people to get not just stressed out about this, but also cynical about, oh man, we have to
just another damn thing,
another training session or relearn something that I've already known. It was working perfectly fine. Why do I need to do this now? And it's just, man. And it happens.
Training though, training was one of the solutions that came up a lot in this literature. Meaning, I think the phrase that was used repeatedly was literacy facilitation, but basically giving people tools to continue to learn and increase their expertise with the system. And so I do think it's kind of a mundane solution, but I do think that's the kind of thing that managers need to be thinking about. How do we make sure that it's not just one and done type training? Okay, you've learned this new system, but making resources accessible for people to learn on their own, you know, continue to explore certain technologies on their own so that they can increase their own comfort level with the tools.
Yes, but I would also argue that it probably has diminishing returns if you have to do it over and over and over again for different types of technologies where the benefits of these new technologies is not immediately obvious.
Yeah, well, I agree. I do agree with that. But that's where, rather than having to do it over and over again, where you're mandating training, I'm thinking more enabling self-learning. So giving people access to resources that they can use or not use as they see fit, right? If they want to learn more about a technology, give them access to resources that they can explore rather than say, okay, you're going to do a training on Monday for 2 hours or something like that, where it's that mandated type of thing. One last recommendation that occurred to me that is not in the literature, that I didn't notice it anywhere, is a policy one, particularly around this idea of techno invasion, maybe creating organizational policies and expectations around presenteeism, right? Telling people, look, our policy is after a certain time of day, you don't need to be checking emails or you don't need to be on the team chat. My wife uses a system where it's like a Slack type channel where it's just a chat board that's always available and people will often reach out to others through that. Well, that's one where I think it would be very important to set the expectation that if you're sending a chat at 6 p.m., people aren't going to respond to it until the next morning. Mm-hmm. And you just have to learn how to live with that. And so I think setting those types of communication channels that enable people to maintain certain boundaries, I think would be really big for increasing job satisfaction.
And I think for leaders, it's really important in these situations to lead by example, because it's very easy to say, don't respond to emails after 6 o'clock or to texts after 6 o'clock, but then you respond. It reminds me of that Curb episode about Ben Stiller's birthday where he says, don't bring a gift, but really you expect everybody to bring gifts, and when Larry David comes into the party without a gift, he gets really upset with him.
And so I didn't see that episode, but I can already visualize Larry David's response. You said don't bring a gift. Yeah.
Lead by example.
Yeah, I think that's a good takeaway.
All right. Shall we talk about what went down today?
Absolutely. So why don't you start? Because I think I already gave away mine.
Oh, wait. So do you have a new one?
I might need to come up with one. Okay. I do have a new one.
Okay. So you get started.
It's a death.
A what?
A death. Someone died on this day in 1972. How should I give you a hint? It's someone who had an incredibly significant impact in the United States for many generations because of his leadership of a federal agency.
Oh.
For decades. He led the agency for decades.
Is it one of the surveillance agencies in the US?
It is.
Is it the FBI?
It is the FBI.
Yeah, I don't remember. Is it? It's no Hoover, is it?
It is. J. Edgar Hoover. Good job. You got to it. J. Edgar Hoover died on this day in 1972.
How old was he when he died?
That's a good question. I'll have to go back and look.
Did he die of natural causes?
He died on the same day. This was another one I was thinking about giving you. Somebody was born on the same day that J. Edgar Hoover died.
Well, many people were born that day.
Well, a famous person.
Okay. In what domain were they famous?
Actor. And formerly athlete.
Actor and formerly athlete.
Big action star in the United States was born on May 2nd, 1972.
Were they a professional athlete?
Yes.
Would I know them? Were they famous for being an athlete before they became an actor?
Yes, but athlete might be throwing you off a little bit.
Okay.
Very famous actor.
And they're still alive, presumably.
Action star.
Yeah.
1972. So 51-year-old, well, now 52-year-old action star as of today.
I can't think of any names of I'm thinking Schwarzenegger, Sly, who's much older.
Yeah, those guys are older.
Bruce Willis, who's older. Jason Statham, who's, I believe, English.
He might be around the same age, though.
Yeah, I don't know.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Oh, The Rock.
So The Rock was born on the same day that J. Edgar Hoover died.
Right. What kind of athlete was he before he became an actor?
He was a wrestler, professional wrestler. Oh. That's why I said it might throw you off.
Yeah, that's... Okay.
Oh. I think he played, or at least he was on a team in the NFL for a little while, but I don't know that he...
Really?
Had a career there. Yeah.
Okay. So my question to you is from the realm of politics.
Okay.
And it happened tomorrow, in fact, not today. So it would have been the 4th of May, 1979. What significant political event happened on that day, the 4th of May, 1979? I'll give you another hint. In a European...
Iran hostage crisis?
In a European country.
Oh, okay. 1979. So that would have been right around the Iran hostage crisis. So it's got to be the end of the Carter administration, European country. Still during the Cold War, so it could have been something. And was this maybe the early emergence of solidarity in Poland or something like that?
No, Western European country.
Okay.
Do you want another hint?
Was it? I think 79 is too early for the marriage of Charles and Diana, but it would have been close on that time.
So you got the country, right?
Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was elected.
Correct. She came into office on the 4th of May, 1979.
Yeah, you don't really elect prime ministers. That's true. Yeah.
What? Well, you do. What do you mean?
You elect a party, and then the party. They don't vote for prime ministers.
Right.
Okay. Nice. Okay.
There are no societies, only individuals.
I am, given my own libertarian leanings. I think Margaret Thatcher was great. Lots of people still bash her now, but I think she did some important things in the UK. Of course, lots of people of my ethnic derivation are not fans. She was not great to the Irish.
On that happy note.
Yes.
Let's call it a day.
Good discussion. Thanks, Ori.
Talk again soon.